From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the 1970s when a young man went to see an orchestra for the first time. This fifth grade student watched the Trenton Symphony Orchestra, and even though he was already learning to play the piano and the saxophone, he was enchanted by the sounds. In particular, he was in awe of the vibrancy of the strings. You see, the home stereo systems at the time couldn't come close to capturing the power of live music. 5 years later, this student arrived at a life-changing moment. He saw a performance of a piece called Is There Anything Still There? The music was being performed by the Eastman Studio Orchestra, but this 10th grader didn't know anything about Eastman. He just knew that music had afflicted him with a purpose. He decided that this would be his career at that moment, and that student's name was Jamal Rossi. How interesting that Jamal Rossi fell permanently in love with music while watching the Eastman Studio Orchestra. And today, he is the dean of the Eastman School of Music, and we welcome him to Connections. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, take me back to that fifth grade moment first. You were listening, were you listening to eight tracks at home back in those days? And I'm trying to remember.
Not really. I think it was LPs.
LPs. couldn't quite capture the live performance?
Not really. And the music that my parents listened to was not necessarily symphony orchestras, but there were strings in the background. So on this school field trip to go hear the Trenton Symphony Orchestra, just hearing the power of that live performance and those strings, it was very special. And it's something I've never forgotten.
The strings are what moved you, even though you have always been a saxophone player. I guess that's because when you hear that kind of a performance live, it's so different than hearing it, even today, recorded.
I think, I truly believe it's the power of music. Yep. I mean, I think that it doesn't matter what one plays or does. It is that power of music, regardless of the genre or the style, to move people. And it's a very intangible thing, but I think that's what it was. The other thing was just the sheer quality of the sound. I think the first thing that we are attracted to in music is the sound, and that was special.
Not every one of us has a career that we can look back on a moment and know that that was sort of the hinge, that that was the fulcrum that, that set us on that course. And you look at that 10th grade moment that you described so beautifully to my colleague, Brenda Tremblay, that you talk about, you know, listening to the piece there, Is There Anything Still There? And why that moment for you? You were already playing music up to that point. Why was that the moment where things kind of were cemented for you?
So I already was very involved in music. Yeah. I love music. That was I was very involved in our band program on the weekends. My friends and I got together and played. So it was already a very important part of my life. But I was also coming to that decision point of what do I want to do with my life? And my other passion at the time was architecture. And so I was reading a lot of architectural journals, and I still love architecture to this day. And we went to many concerts together. At that time, I was so into jazz, so we were going to Buddy Rich and Stan Kenton and Maynard Ferguson and this new guy in the scene, Chuck Mangione. And so, you know, there are about five of us, and this is what we did. But that particular performance, this was a work that featured a tenor saxophone, and I was happened to be playing tenor at that time. And it was just such an amazing performance. And again, I think the thing that music can do is it communicates in a very special way. It communicates in a way that words cannot and pictures cannot. It is very difficult to describe. But at that moment, that playing touched me in a very profound way, and I just knew this is what I want to do. I love playing my instrument. I want to be able to have this kind of impact in others' lives the way this person just impacted mine.
You ever track down that Eastman Studio Orchestra?
Well, you know, it was actually years before I put the connection together. I mean, I had been a student here for my doctorate degree and left, and it was really years later where I sort of put it all together that was that Eastman Studio Orchestra.
Wow.
And really, I had the opportunity to study with Ray Wright as a student here, and Ray was just a brilliant individual, one of the great teachers in the rich history of Eastman's teaching legacy. And so it was. There's something very sweet, actually, about that coming full circle.
I love the symmetry there. We're talking to my guest for the hour, the dean of the Eastman School of Music, Jamal Rossi, and it's a special week for Rochester. It's the Jazz Festival. You have Eastman students performing on a daily and nightly basis, and You know, I'm curious to know if you can really enjoy a week like this. I mean, you have this peripatetic week in which you have to be everywhere, but can you stop and enjoy it at any point?
I would tell you, I relish this week, and I go to performances really because that's where I want to be. There's nothing obligatory that I have to be at this performance or that performance. I choose those artists that I really want to hear. And for the 9 years that I've been at Eastman, I would say that if an Eastman student or faculty member is playing someplace, I try very hard to be there. It matters to me to hear what those people are doing and to be able to support them. So as you say, we have a lot of performers this week.
Yeah, we do. We do. And I was thinking about the slate tonight and texting with a colleague this morning, and someone asked me, does media have to buy tickets? And I said, well, you know. And so I was curious. You know, we get that question. When's the last time Jamel Rossi bought a ticket for a musical event?
Well, and not so many at the Eastman School of Music. I wouldn't think you're not buying tickets. But anytime I'm out of town, generally that's what I do. If I'm in New York City, I will buy tickets to either Metropolitan Opera or to hear the New York Phil or wherever I'm at. What I want to do is check out the great music that's there. So that's when I'm buying tickets.
Yeah, very good. Well, so this week is enjoyable for you. What are some of the highlights so far?
Well, let's see. First of all, 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to hear Steve Martin, and I did not know what to expect, but that was one of the great concert experiences ever. So Saturday night was another great Steve Martin concert. Everything about that concert is just pure joy for me. The music, the musicianship, the jokes, it was great.
Can I stop for a second and just jump in on the Steve Martin thing?
Yeah.
And we're going to go on a little bit of a tangent now, but I read a piece last year by Zadie Smith in The New Yorker in which she's a fiction writer and does some other nonfiction writing, but she said she has so many interests and she has this anxiety that she's constantly fighting because she would love to learn to speak German. She would love to become a wine expert. She would love to be a great chef. But there's only so much time in life to become truly proficient and really technically skilled at a lot of things. And this is where I think this is not fair that Steve Martin has been able to do this because, like you say, you don't know what to expect. And then you see him and he's not Steve Martin, sort of the goofy comedian. He's truly a gifted performer on the stage, isn't he?
I believe so. I think he is a real Renaissance man. Again, a great writer. He talked about being a writer for the Smothers Brothers. And if you look at his credits, he was a writer for others. A great comedic presence. In fact, he's a good fiction writer. I've read some of his works. He's an art aficionado. And then here he is on stage, not just as a front man or not just letting the others handle the real stuff. He is a real musician through and through. And a number of the compositions were his, and they were excellent.
Yeah.
So he is a tremendous
talented guy. Does it make you think, I can do this architecture thing on the side?
No.
It's an amazing thing to say. Okay, so Steve Martin, what are some of the other highlights?
You know, I heard a young saxophonist the other night who, I think her name was Melissa Adala, and I did not know her. She's a young saxophonist from Chile. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable player. She's the kind of player that... in fact, she was in the atrium near Max's restaurant, and my office overlooks that. So during the sound check, I hear the sound checks every afternoon. I had to stop and check out, who is this? And it goes back to one, her sound was just so rich, and there was substance there. But what she had to say with her music was special. So I had a difficult time completing my work that afternoon during the sound check, and then I made sure I came back for her evening performance. It was spectacular.
How much pleasure do you get from seeing Eastman students, even if it's at the small venues or sort of the off the beaten path? I mean, that's what to me the pleasure of the Jazz Fest is. There's so many different places to see great performers. What kind of pleasure do you get from the Eastman?
It's true. I just have so much pride won for them. This is what they came to do. They are passionate about it. And for those students who I really get to know over a period of 4 years, or sometimes they'll go into a graduate degree and I know them for a longer period of time, seeing their growth is very special. But also just seeing them in their element. So if they're playing as a trio in some small venue, this is really what they want to do. This is their passion. And to see them thriving in that is just great.
What's your favorite small venue in this town?
Wow. Well, it's not a jazz venue. And I'll tell you, I think one of the great additions to Rochester happens to be the Hatch Recital Hall that was part of the Eastman East Wing project from a few years ago. It is a spectacular space.
Do you know anything about that project?
I know a little bit about that project, and I don't think it's special because I had involvement.
No, I kid. But I know you're intimately familiar with it, and rave reviews this week about that.
It is great. I mean, this week, this is the second or third year where the Jazz Festival has a piano series, and it is a great piano in a great hall, and it's so intimate. It's 200 people, and it just feels fantastic. It sounds fantastic. I think the artists love playing there because they get a this great vibe from the audience. So I love that space.
I had an interesting conversation with a friend the other day who was complaining about some of the non-jazz music performers during Jazz Week. And, you know, you can debate about whether some of the more mainstream players are jazz. It never bothered me because I think music is not monolithic, and I talked about that yesterday with Vijay Iyer about the fact that music kind of crosses over. Does it bother you at all when you see non-jazz?
It does not bother me. I believe so much of music is just meeting people where they are. I believe last year we had about 195,000 people at the Jazz Festival. I bet most of them were not passionate jazz fans, but they came down because of the event and the experience. And I love the logo of the Jazz Festival. It's not who you know, it's who you don't know. So the fact that these people are experiencing musicians they've never heard of before and enjoying it, and often enjoying it with friends, I think that is a fantastic experience. And that's why we have hundreds of thousands of people coming out and enjoying this fantastic Jazz Festival.
Just to prove I can relate anything to World Cup football, because it's this week, I had talked to a friend the other day and said, I wish I were in Kansas City or Chicago, these big public viewing, because when you have these big public viewing and you have these great moments, he said, most of the people there, they don't really love soccer. They might not even know anybody on the team. They want to be there together for great moments. And it sounds kind of what you're describing with the Jazz Festival.
But I also imagine those people who may be experiencing that for the first time are having such a great time, it will not be the last time.
Yeah.
Some of those folks are going to say, I had no idea. I want to learn more about soccer. I had no idea. I want to learn more about jazz. I love this. I didn't realize how cool it was or how varied it was. And so, again, that's when I talk about meeting people where they are. I think if they come and have a fantastic experience, they are more likely to come back.
And you obviously already talked about Steve Martin, but give me in the name of a performer who, when you saw them live for the first time, you knew they were great in studio. You couldn't believe how good they were live.
I'm not sure that I can do that.
There's
a lot
here,
Evan. Yeah, I'd have to think about that.
I am always amazed when I see a music performance that is better live than they are in studio.
I think that we were talking about sports, and I think it is similar to sports. When you watch basketball on TV, I don't watch that much hockey or hockey on TV or things like that. I don't think you have a sense of really how fast that is until you are there live.
Agreed.
It is a different experience. So when I hear Itzhak Perlman on the radio or on a recording, it is beautiful. Hearing it live, it is a different experience, and it is that much more special.
Love that. Well, my guest for the hour is Jamil Rossi, the Dean of the Eastman School of Music. And as I mentioned, he recently spoke to my colleague from Classical 91.5, Brenda Tremblay, and you mentioned a couple of things about your own listening habits. So first of all, I don't mean to challenge you too hard, but is it really possible that you occasionally listen to country?
Oh, darn. It's out of the bag. I do, actually. And I'll tell you how I started. I would not call myself a country music fan. But I'll tell you how I started listening to it. And it actually had to do with awards shows. So if I think back about 10 years ago and I'd watch the Grammys and I'd watch these shows, there's a lot of talk in some music. And you put the country music award show on and it was a concert. It was just constant music. And I was struck by the fact that, one, I could understand virtually all the lyrics, and many of those people were outstanding musicians. So I have come to appreciate some of them. I mean, one person who I just love her music, she was at CMAC a few years ago. I can't wait till she comes back. That's Alison Krauss in Union Station. She's a fantastic composer. She's a great violinist. And there's something so authentic in her voice and the quality of her voice. I just love her music.
You also said that occasionally you will binge listen. And I didn't fully, I want you to explain what you mean by binge listen.
So I gave an example to Brenda in that I think it was junior year of college. Part of going to college is you learn and you discover. And sometimes you think you're discovering something for the first time. Well, in junior year, I discovered Rachmaninoff. And I just thought it was the most fantastic music I had heard. And probably for 6 months, I didn't listen to anything except Rachmaninoff. Anything I could find, I would listen to. At that time, this was before we were streaming music on podcasts. So it was a lot of time spent in the listening library. I just listened to everything I could because I was so taken by the power of his music. So again, there are times where what I'm listening to is jazz. There are other times what I'm listening to is classical saxophone because I'm getting ready for a performance and I want to be so engrossed in that medium and in that sound. I just spend most of my time listening in that area.
Let's listen to a clip if we could. I think you might recognize some of this, and we'll come back and talk about why it affects you this way. Let's listen to the first one. The disclaimer I'll use is that, as I said yesterday with Vijay Iyer, you cannot take just a 30 to 40 second clip of classical or music of this genre and really fully appreciate it, but you instantly were moved when you heard it. That's Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 2. Why does it move you that way?
Amazing music, amazing playing. I think that may have been the recording of Vladimir Horowitz playing with the New York Phil. Now it's almost 30 years ago. I'm not sure if that's the performance or not, but just very special emotional writing and playing. The interesting thing I find about music is we talk about music being the universal language. I think there's something that's not exactly full in that because it's not just the music. It is the way it is performed that communicates that message. And so that's a piece that's very special.
Speaking of the way it's performed, The Atlantic Magazine has a recent piece called The Romantic Power of Music. And in that piece, the author writes the following, quote, "Using his whole body, his undulating eyebrows, his wild arms, even his swaying hips, Liszt drove Handel's Fugue in E minor with vigor and unfettered confidence, keeping perfect tempo and playing entirely with memory. It was the start of the phenomenon later called Listomania, and the women in the audience went mad. Charles Darwin hypothesized that musical skill led to better mating options, not just for birds, but for humans as well. Musical notes and rhythm, Darwin wrote in The Descent of Man, were first acquired by the male and female progenitors of mankind for the sake of charming the opposite sex." Dean Rossi, what do you think? Hard to argue with it, isn't it?
I think I'm speechless.
You can't argue with Darwin on that, but there is a sensuality to music, especially with, not just the music itself, but the way it is performed. And it was fascinating to me to go back and read about Liszt and Listomania because the women were moved, they were aroused watching his performance. And there is something that communicates more than just the sound, isn't it?
I think it is all about communication, and I think that there is an infinite way to communicate that. You mentioned Vijay Iyer. He was a man who walked on stage last night very slowly, very calmly. He sat down. There was nothing flashy about it at all. But the moment he started playing, he owned the audience. He had everybody in his power. Somebody else could walk on stage confidently, sit down and be flashy, and they can do the same thing or not. So, again, there's something about the authenticity of the musician and the way he or she performs the music. When they're trying to do something that isn't authentic, I think that's when it is not so effective.
I'd like to play a second clip. This one is going to be even more familiar, if that's possible, to Jamal Rossi. Let's listen to this one. ¶¶ That arrangement goes back to 1995, I think.
If you say so.
Okay. And I'm curious to know how much saxophone you get to play these days.
Well, I would, on the one hand, I'd say not as much as I want to, mm-hmm. but it is because I'm doing what I want to do. But I still love playing the saxophone. I still am an active performer. The last few weeks, I haven't played very much, but I am looking forward to getting back into the discipline of daily playing and daily practice and selecting performances.
One of these years, we're going to see you in a smoky back room during the Jazz Fest, unlabeled, no name on the marquee, just playing saxophone?
Probably not.
Probably not. That, of course, your arrangement of Paganini, is
yes.
that? Paganini. What does that music and that... that piece we just played, what does that mean to you?
Well, there's a little bit of history to that piece and why I chose to transcribe it. And it has to do partly with me and the way I do things and partly my inspiration. So at Eastman, there is a remarkable flute professor by the name of Benita Boyd. And I heard Benita Boyd play a number of Paganini caprices on flute when I was a student here in the 1980s. And I thought, we can do this on saxophone. If she could do that on flute, I believe we can do this on saxophone. And the other inspiration had to do with the fact that I was trying to master a technique. It's called double tonguing. And normally on an instrument, one single tongues. They go ta-ta-ta. Double tonguing is going ta-ka-ta-ka. And when you do it fast, it's ta-ka-ta-ka-ta-ka-ta. So I was not able to do it on the saxophone. But I was teaching a sophomore flutist who could do it beautifully. And I thought, if she can do this, I can master it. So I decided to transcribe a Paganini caprice and to work on it until I could hopefully play it to the level of Bonnie Boyd. I'm not sure that's possible. And that I would also master double tonguing. And so that's why I put that together.
It turned out beautifully, didn't it? That's not for
you.
I'll
leave that for you.
I would say so. We're talking to our guest for the hour is Jamil Rossi, the dean of the Eastman School of Music. I got ahead of myself a little bit. I mean, the recent news of your permanent elevation to the position, we already have had some questions on Twitter with people asking just your thoughts about the legacy of the position you hold and your thoughts about the history of the school that that is now a permanent home. And just give us your thoughts on... I don't know what the pressure is the right word, but the importance of the position.
Well, first let's start with the word that the person who wrote the tweet used. It is a legacy position. And I would tell you it is both an honor and incredibly humbling to now have this position full time. Because when I think of the legacy of leaders who have held that, going back to Howard Hansen, but Bob Freeman was a great director of the school for 24 years. Jim Underkoffler did some truly remarkable and innovative things. And most recently, my friend Doug Lowry really made an impact, not only at Eastman, but in the world of music. So there's a tremendous legacy to uphold. I don't know that I would say I feel a pressure to do that, but I am keenly aware that that is my responsibility to do something that is going to matter.
We're going to take the shortest break in radio and come right back because we're just scratching the surface on what the future of the Eastman School of Music will be like in the short and long term, especially with the challenges of the cost of higher education, the value of the importance of bringing as many students from diverse backgrounds to Eastman, and to make sure that Eastman continues to be the beacon for such talented students that we're seeing not only all year long, but especially during the week of the Jazz Festival. My guest, Jamil Rossi, we're coming right back on Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, it's our first Fiction Authors Roundtable. Four local published authors share their approach to writing. How do they avoid distractions? How do they find inspiration? Every author has a different process, and we'll learn about what works for our panel during our roundtable of authors, coming up next hour on Connections with Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. Had another question on Twitter about the fact that it's Jazz Week. Might as well mention the music that's the theme of the show, and I'm happy to do that. That's the band is called Ra Ra Riot. They're from Geneva, New York. Went to Syracuse University, and they have incorporated strings to pop music throughout their history. And they, my goal is eventually to get them to play that song for us in studio. But thanks to Ra Ra Riot and Barsuk Records for lending their talent. Always nice to hear strings and pop music, isn't it, Jamal? I always love sort of the, just a little bit of a curveball is always nice for me in music.
It has been there for so long. I think about even a tune like Yesterday with Paul McCartney. It was a string quartet backing him up, and they go back long before that in popular music.
We're talking to Jamal Rossi, the dean of the Eastman School of Music, and he came back to Eastman 9 years ago now, right?
Correct.
9 years. And you came back during Jazz Festival Week of all times to come back, and there was a moment that stood out to you that before the hour, we were talking about the fact that sometimes when you've got something truly special in your hometown, it's easy to be sort of inured to the grandeur and the beauty of it. And I get that. We all can be cynical or sort of lose sight of the value of something right in front of us. Well, you went away and came back 9 years ago. Tell me about that moment when you came back during the Jazz Festival Week.
So I was coming to a concert with a friend, and we drove up to the school, and we're talking in the car, and from the walk to, from the parking lot into the school, and the whole time we're just having a conversation. And we walk in the theater, and this person just continued to talk and was unfazed. And I walked in, and I was struck again by what a remarkable theater the Eastman Theater is. Just, it is so incredibly beautiful and special. And I realized at that moment that my friend grew up with this theater, probably went here to hear the Rochester Philharmonic in fifth grade, probably graduated from here in high school, and his brothers and sisters walked across the stage. And so it was just the hometown theater. And my thought was the fact that this is what he knows, and he assumes this is just the way it is every place. But this is an incredibly special theater. And having been away for 25 years, I know this is not what you find every place else. This is a very special and unique space. Quite frankly, having a school like the Eastman School of Music in a city of any size, but especially a city of this size, it is very special and very unique, and I just think it adds so much to the vibrancy of the city.
Your path back to Eastman was not an obvious one from the get-go. I mean, you talked about as a student in your 20s wanting to be the best saxophone player you could be, not necessarily an administrator. You end up in Aberdeen, South Dakota at, was it Northern State University?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of started nudging down the path towards administration there. Not necessarily full-time, right? But at least you did some chair work, I think.
Correct.
And then it was, you weren't even 30 years old when you, the big change to me it looks like in your timeline was when you went to Ithaca. What did you do at Ithaca?
So when I left Eastman in 1985, I had the opportunity to go to a number of different positions. Many of them, I should say several of them, were replacing somebody who was going to be on leave for a semester or a year, teaching saxophone. And this is very much what I wanted to do. But I also had this opportunity to go to South Dakota, where it would be a full-time position and it would be my job. And that's what I wanted. I wanted my job where I could learn how to teach and how to really become a fine professor and also a great performer. While there, had the opportunity to become department chair, and I was approached by the dean of Ithaca College, which is where I did my undergraduate degree, about coming back to Ithaca in a full-time administrative position. And that was a very challenging and hard decision for me because I saw my career trajectory as becoming a professor, advancing through the professorial ranks, and also being a very active performer. And perhaps someday moving into administration, but not at that point in my life. But here's a chance to go back to a great school of music, a school that I cared very deeply about, and also to be near family. And that matters very much both to myself and my wife, and we were starting a young family. So all of those things together were important. The key was the agreement I reached with the dean, whose name is Art Ostrander, who has been a key mentor to me throughout my career and perhaps one of my closest friends now, in that if I was going to take this administrative role, I wanted to continue to be a very active performer. I wanted to continue to have that part of my career grow. And he was tremendously supportive of that, as were the faculty at Ithaca. So as a result, it was actually a tremendously productive time in my life as a creative artist. That's when I did most of my performing as a soloist or with concertos. I had the chance to record a number of, make a couple of recordings. So I really attribute that to the support of this particular dean who enabled me to do that.
How many administrators can say that they have a successful artist career in artistry at the same time? Most of the time you don't have a parallel to that, right?
I think in music it matters, and quite frankly, a good many of the people I know in music administration do care about remaining active as a performer or in their discipline. I think a good example is Doug Lowry. Doug remained very active as a composer throughout his entire career. That mattered to him. For me, I certainly intend to continue to perform. It is part of who we are as musicians. It's not what we do. It's part of who we are. And it also, I wouldn't say it helps me remember why I do this, but it matters. I remember why this matters so much.
And now, as the dean, you've got to confront the cost of higher education. Everybody mm-hmm. does in education. And when we're talking about roughly $250,000 over 4 years in many institutions now, that's a harder sell than it was. And I say it's a harder sell because it has far outpaced inflation. 40 years ago this year, the cost of education for the average private school in the country was $14,000. This year it's $40,000. A lot of the top schools are around $60,000. And let me start by asking you, because as an administrator now, why do you think the cost has gone up so much?
I think that, first of all, it is an expensive proposition. There are various different kinds of institutions. At the University of Rochester, we are a research one institution. We have a big medical center. So there are many things that we do. I believe in the concept that a great teacher is also somebody who is great as a professional. So in music, that means our faculty members are still very active performers and researchers. Well, at the university, it's the same for scientists and doctors and others. There is a cost to making all of those things work together. I agree with you. I think the cost of higher education is very high, and it is one of the big factors that we face. For us at Eastman, the key is providing scholarship money, and we are in a market where we are competing for the very best students. And I don't necessarily mean just the person who plays the best. I mean the student who is intellectually curious, who really wants what we want. And this is an international market. So we are auditioning. This year, I think we had 2,300 applicants from around the world. And we have admitted a class of roughly 250 undergraduate and graduate students. The key is to enroll the students who really want what we want and to make it affordable for them. And the only way one makes that affordable is scholarship money. And so going forward, that is one of my primary objectives, is to make certain that we are making a connection with people who care about the future of music and want to see that thrive and who want to be part of helping these young people become great musicians, so that we could attract more scholarship dollars for these students.
And you said that you want students who want, essentially want what Eastman wants, which is a potentially great musician, but who also wants a well-rounded education. And you look at, say, Juilliard. Juilliard is a conservatory that if a musician wants to go for 8, 10, 12 hours a day and just bury themselves in music, they can do that. At Eastman, they have to pick up books still. And you have told me that you don't think that is a disadvantage for Eastman.
I do not in any way. In fact, many people refer to Eastman as a conservatory.
And it's not, is it?
It's not, and it's never been. It looks like a conservatory. It's an older building. It's off on its own. It's not on a college campus. But it has always been a comprehensive school of music. To me, that means two things. One is we offer a comprehensive range of programs. So certainly we have programs in performance in classical performance, in jazz, in composition, in music education. But we also have degrees in academic areas, musicology and music theory and ethnomusicology. To me, that creates an incredibly rich environment where these students interact with each other. The other part of that comprehensive is truly comprehensive education. I think that a great, when we were talking before about the power of music and the performance and the communication, I think a great artist has something to say. They have something to say not only because they know how to technically move around their instrument, but because they are curious, they are inquisitive, they are lifelong learners, they lead interesting lives. I think that is whatever we can do to encourage students to foster that attitude, to leave Eastman recognizing that they are only scratching the surface of what they will need to know as a great musician, I think they will have every opportunity to be successful when they leave us.
And you talk about more scholarships. How do you do that? How do you get to that point? I mean, have you set specific goals in terms of what you need to have to be able to offer in terms of scholarship, and how do you get there?
Well, I think part of it is, again, finding those people who care deeply about music and who also want to make a difference in students' lives, and trying to work with them to raise funds.
Donors, yeah.
Donors who really see this as an important element in the future of music. And there are many different components to do that. But that is a key part, I think, of our going forward. When I look at some of our peers in the country, they have experienced some major gifts over the last 10 or 15 years. We want to continue to be not only one of, we want to be, you know, truly the exceptional school of music. And so truly, we need to compete on that level.
My guest for the hour is Jamil Rossi, the Dean of the Eastman School of Music, who happens to have been involved in what I think is one of the more, for me, it's an amazing story, because I can't imagine ever doing it. And we're talking about fundraising. You had to get in a room with folks and sit down, and they know why you're there, and you know they know why you're there. But at some point, you have to look across the table and say, we're going to need you to give us $10 million. And Kodak did. How do you ask somebody for $10 million?
Well, first of all, you follow the lead of a great president. And so, again, you know, that was a special moment when President Seligman really had a very special relationship with the president of Kodak. And as you say, they knew why we were coming.
They knew why you're there.
But
they don't ever say yes right away to a big number like that, right? There's a little bit of a...
I think most often somebody says, thank you, I will consider that.
Right.
And one of the best pieces of advice I received years ago when I was first getting started in advancement work was, when somebody says no, you just have to hear, not now. And so that has served me well, to be able to say, if somebody says no, I'm not interested, that doesn't mean no forever. It just means not now.
But it's rarely, yes, right now, here's $10 million.
Once in a while.
How significant was that moment in the last 5 to 10 years? Look back at the importance of what has been going on at Eastman. How significant was that?
Well, I think the renovation of the Eastman Theater and the addition to the school was a major project that really helped to... bring to Eastman and to Rochester some much-needed vitalization. We had spaces that we needed. Hatch Recital Hall was something that had been talked about for, 40 years. I found a feasibility study from 1972
Wow.
about building a recital hall on what had been a parking lot. So clearly it had been a dream of many directors and faculty members for many decades. We needed rehearsal spaces. We needed some recording spaces. So that was critical to us. The renovation to the theater, I think, was very important for, look at the Jazz Festival now. That is the anchor spot for this festival. And it is not only beautiful, as it has always been, it is now acoustically wonderful, and it hadn't always been. For the Rochester Philharmonic, I think that renovation was vital to them, because that organization draws on average 1,500 or 1,600 people to a concert. That is actually a fantastic audience to come to a classical music concert. But in a hall that was 3,000 seats, the hall looked half empty, which is a very different feeling than looking primarily full. So by the reconfiguration of the hall, by adding the boxes on the side, it now has a much more intimate feel, much more welcoming feel. I'm gratified because I believe the musicians love it, and I think the patrons love it. So there are many, many people who are involved in that, and I think they all deserve great credit for a successful project.
Well, a good leader, and you have said this, doesn't ask for the credit. And I think in this kind of a project, there's been great leadership that's come from you. You have been very interested in the notion of leadership. And I don't know if you still teach a course. Do you still teach leadership issues in music?
I do.
You do? Leadership issues in music. So I want to ask about that in just a minute. But I would love for you to describe what you think the difference is between a leader and a boss.
Well, I can't remember who said this, but I thought it was a great quote. But somebody said, a leader is somebody people will follow even when they don't have to. A boss is somebody you sort of have to follow.
You better if you want to keep, yes.
And so again, I mean,
that's
think
a great point.
I think that a leader is one who not only brings his or her own vision to the organization, but they have the capacity to coalesce a collective vision among everybody. They have the ability to inspire people to work toward that. I think often when you take on an ambitious goal, it is not always easy to achieve it. And when it's achieved, you realize some of the best periods of the journey were actually getting there. I think a good leader is somebody who can keep the troops together, who is not daunted by challenges that come up, and just keeps persevering towards achieving the goals.
We're going to grab our first phone call there. I haven't even mentioned the number, by the way, because I've been so wrapped up in the conversation. Sorry, Jamal. Bill, we're going to grab you in just a second, but let me just follow up and ask you. The course, Leadership Issues in Music. Mm-hmm. What are leadership issues in music?
Well, so this is a course through our Institute of Music Leadership. We have a certificate program called the Arts Leadership Program. And so these are students who are pursuing that certificate program. And what we talk about in there are truly those issues that arts leaders typically have to deal with. The last number of years, that issue has primarily been finances, because when you look at arts organizations, there are struggles, there are challenges to be fiscally viable. But we also look at how an organization is run. We look at different styles of leadership. And all of these students actually are charged with finding an organization, typically in a nationally recognized organization, and interviewing the CEO to find out how they deal with certain issues. And we talk, we choose collectively what those topics will be. I think it has been a great experience for some of these students. They have interviewed the CEOs of Carnegie Hall, Metropolitan Opera, San Francisco Opera, major arts organizations, Kennedy Center, and others. Sometimes the CEO has invited the people to come and interview them in person. And I think these students have gotten an awful lot out of that.
Wonderful. Let's grab Bill in Greece. Thanks for calling Connections. Bill, you're on with Jamal Rossi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to ask your guest, are they going to be doing the international piano competition this year or in the near future?
Thanks.
Enjoy going to that.
Yeah, thanks for the call and the question. The international piano competition will take place next year. That competition had been an annual event, and then the last competition, the decision was made that it would become every other year. It actually, we have a three-year hiatus because the director of the competition, Professor Doug Humphreys, has also become the artistic director of the Bachauer International Piano Competition, which is a major competition. So we wanted to coordinate our schedules so that they would alternate years. So in fact, this week right now is the finals of the Bachauer competition in Salt Lake City. And then next summer, we will have the Eastman International Piano Competition here in Rochester.
You talk about finances, talking to students in the leadership courses about all these different aspects of the business. And I understand when students now are graduating high school and making decisions on their future, they have to think about their career path. And pragmatically, they have to think about whether they can work and sustain a living. And do you suspect there are fewer full-time jobs in music today for graduates of the Eastman School and other schools and the Juilliards, et cetera, than there were 10, 20, 30 years ago?
I think there are different opportunities today than there were 20 or 30 years ago. I think that music has always been a challenging profession. It has always been a competitive profession. It is a profession in which excellence rules, and so, you know, mediocrity has never thrived. So if you talk from a graduate from 50 years ago, they still had to audition for jobs. They had to work. They had to build a career. I think there are fewer traditional jobs than there may have been in the past. There are fewer orchestras than there were 50 years ago. But there are more opportunities. There are more entrepreneurial opportunities. There is an entire online world that did not exist even 20 years ago. So for me, it is a matter of having students focus on being excellent on their instrument or in their discipline, but recognizing that they are going to have to be very versatile, and they are going to have to be willing to do many things well, not just one thing well.
We've got a few minutes left. Can we talk a little bit about rock music?
I'd love to.
Yeah, and I've got a clip if we can, just for the fun of it, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Let's listen. Understand the context. It is great if you understand the context. Tell us about it.
Rock music is a program that I care so deeply about, and I'm so thrilled about how this has come together. This is a program that involves a number of key partner organizations. They are the Eastman School of Music and our community music school, which enrolls about 1,500 students locally, the Hochstein School of Music and Dance, the RPO, the Rochester City School District, and the city. And about 3 to 4 years ago, we came together and asked ourselves, are we being as successful as we can at reaching inner city children and children who do not necessarily have access to music the way students in suburbs are having? And we all agreed that we are all making efforts, but we're not being as successful as we want to. So we joined together. We studied programs around the country. There is a wave called El Sistema, which is that translates the system, which comes from South America. And we saw elements of that that were interesting to us, but it doesn't actually transfer to the United States the way it works in South America. The key, though, was to bring the music to the students. Transportation is a major issue, and to recognize that the idea of having a lesson once a week and going home and practicing for 6 days a week takes a support network that sometimes is challenging for a number of families. So we set up a system where we are offering tuition-free music lessons in the Ghent Community Center, right in the Northeast neighborhood, for about 65 students. They come 3 days a week after school, and this is what they do. And a colleague of mine talks about students voting with their feet. Well, these kids are voting with their feet because they come back every other day. Nobody's forcing them to be there, and they are on fire. And it has just been so gratifying to see these students loving music and this experience. They start ages 6 through 18, and there are two levels. First is called music readiness. So these are the 6 through 8-year-olds who are really doing vocal music. You heard the singing. Mm-hmm. That was really mm-hmm. the younger students.
Yep.
And then from I think 9 years and older, they are playing string instruments. As I say, it's just been so exciting to see the families coming together and supporting this. It is, I think, making a difference in this Northeast neighborhood. We just had our first student accepted to the School of the Arts and to what's called Eastman Pathways, which is a tuition-free program to take lessons and classes at the Eastman Community Music School. So this is just a great program. I think that the city is interested in seeing it expand to other community centers. And the fact that we have 5 key partners in it, I believe that this will sustain for many, many years.
Great stuff. We didn't even get through everything I'd like to talk this hour, and I didn't even mention the phone number once. We still had a call here. How about the next time you come in, I'll open up the lines right at the beginning. We'll have more listener interaction, and we'll do it again sometime.
I would love that. Thank you.
Congratulations not only on your position, but the success of Eastman and the success of what is another fabulous Jazz Week. I know big time excitement for you and the students there, and we'll see you out among the crowds, I guess, for the next few days.
I will be there.
Jamil Rossi is the dean of the Eastman School of Music, taking the time for us this hour in Connections. Short break, then we're coming right back. If you've ever thought you have a book in you, it's our first ever Fiction Authors Roundtable. We're going to find out how they get it done. How do you avoid distractions? How do you meet a deadline? How do you find inspiration? Four authors from our area and the Finger Lakes, live next.